Welcome. For years, I was on the inside. I saw how power really works, how decisions are made, how secrets are kept. Then I exposed the truth about the deep state, and the deep state tried to ruin my life. But they failed. Because the American people deserve to know who is pulling the strings and why. This isn't theory, it's experience. My experience. I'm John Kiriakou. This is The Deep State. I want to bring on now Jay Dyer. Jay is a well-known YouTuber, a Christian apologist, a theologian, and podcaster. He discusses topics from Christianity to geopolitics to the deep state. I want to ask you about this whole anti-Semitism thing. And I have a personal bias. I like to think that I'm an even-handed person. I was trained as an analyst, where I base my opinions on the facts as we know the facts. I'm a supporter of human rights. I've made that clear over the last two decades, to great personal cost. But the Israeli foreign minister's political director wrote an article about 2 months ago in a scholarly journal funded by the Israeli government in which he called me noted anti-Semite John Kiriakou. Well, like you just said, that's a trope that they throw out all the time. I have a dear friend who 25 years ago was in the Israeli Special Forces. He's now an American citizen. And he told me that in school, they were taught to do that, where they were taught if any foreigner, non-Israeli, criticized the Israeli government in any way, they were to accuse the person of anti-Semitism in order to silence them. And now we see it all the time. I'm noted anti-Semite John Kiriakou. Tucker Carlson is anti-Semite of the year, Tucker Carlson. You mentioned a second ago, and I want to agree wholeheartedly, that Twitter has changed that, where we can respond immediately. It's not about anti-Semitism. It's about human rights. I was on the Piers Morgan show a couple of weeks ago, and I was on with General Danny Ayalon and Alan Dershowitz and Scott Horton. Scott Horton and I were on the one side, Ayalon and Dershowitz were on the other. And I did the least amount of talking of all the guests because, you know, that show you constantly just interrupt everybody else. So finally, Piers Morgan asked me, do you believe that October 7th was a terrorist attack? And I said, in that the targets were primarily civilians? Yes, of course. Do you believe that Hamas is a terrorist organization? I said, I don't believe Hamas was set up as a terrorist organization. I believe it was set up as an organization of national liberation. But again, if the goal is to attack civilian populations for the purpose of instilling a feeling of terror for political purposes, yes, of course. Then what is your complaint about Israel? I said, come on, Piers. I said, you cannot have as your policy kill everybody. Killing everybody is not a policy. It's a genocide. It's a crime against humanity. In many cases, it's a war crime. You can't just decide, well, I think what our policy is going to be is just kill everyone, women, children, the sick, the elderly, and then expect the United States to say, okay, we're with you. We're going to help you kill everyone. Do you think that we've turned a corner, perhaps? There was a Gallup poll that was released just a week ago that showed for the very first time a majority of Democrats, a plurality of Americans, support the Palestinian side and not the Israeli side. Is that temporary? Or do you think we've turned a corner and these constant accusations that if you don't agree with absolutely everything that Benjamin Netanyahu says, or Itamar Ben-Gavir, or Smotrich, or any of these other extremists, that you're anti-Semitic? Do you think we're getting past that?
Absolutely, because I see hundreds and hundreds, thousands of comments and posts, you know, over the last 2 years of people pushing back on this very trick. And, you know, I first encountered this in 2007. I remember I was writing some blog posts where I began to critique Zionism because I was out of my, you know, well out of my evangelical phase. And, you know, at the time I was Roman Catholic and I was not at all interested in supporting some, you know, socialist, atheist nation states' foreign policy designs, which have nothing to do with Christianity or America, other than perhaps the military industrial complex, perhaps have some interest there. But other than that, I remember writing some posts in 2007, 8, 9 on a blog back then. And I remember getting, I had other evangelical groups reaching out, threatening to get me fired from where I worked because I had written mild critiques of Zionism. And I realized very quickly that, oh, this is actually a, you know, thing you can't talk about. This, you can't question this. This is deeply entrenched across the board in America. And since that time, it's amazing to me to see from 2007, 8, 9 and the level of censorship that was put into place even back in the early 2010s. I remember I got the first 1-year ban that I'd ever, I mean, I may not be the actual first, remember, I got the first 1-year ban from Facebook for questioning aspects of Zionist stuff. This is 2012 or 13. We had a huge debate in comments, and I got a message the next day, you're banned for 1 year from Facebook because you touched on, you know, quote, anti-Semitic topics. Now, I'm only saying those as sort of just my own personal experience examples. And then you fast forward to now to see millions and millions of people beginning to say, hey, wait a minute, this makes no sense. And I always caution people that when you get the pendulum swinging in the other direction, a lot of times what the system or the establishment wants to do is then swing everybody in even to a further extreme to make it look absurd. Mm-hmm. And so you have within the last couple of years, all of these neo-pagan Hitler bots that pop up everywhere, just pushing National Socialism as if this is some actual real thing that you could go back to, which is absurd to me. But I think that's, we have to be careful about going to this extreme and trying to have a level, rational, realistic head about what is actually possible. We're not going to have a Führer. We're not going to have a king. We're not going to have these things. So we need to think logically and realistically about where we are. And it absolutely is a massive victory to be able to talk about these things, to begin to shift American opinion away from the default position that we have to do whatever BB says. And it's just so ridiculous when you see these old clips where 20 years ago, you see BB's like, if you want to change Iran, beam into Iran, Melrose Place on 90210, and he will change the culture. He's literally saying, like, Hollywood will change Iran if you just use the mind control pop culture. And there's that other clip where he says, America does whatever Israel wants. We've got him by the, you know, balls or whatever he says. Mm-hmm. It's like he just says this stuff openly. But if you say what he says, you're bad for quoting him. Well, it's a hypocritical double standard, and everybody's just tired of it. So absolutely, the tides are turning.
You know, one of the other things that bothers me very much is when people present the issue as this either or, this black and white issue.
Yes.
Well, you know, you're going to support the Muslims, they'll throw you off the roof if you're gay. Or, oh, I suppose you've been to a church in the Middle East. Actually, I've been to a lot of churches in the Middle East, a lot. I was at the dedication of the first Greek Orthodox church in Bahrain. I attended an Armenian Orthodox church when I was stationed in Kuwait. There are churches all over Doha and Abu Dhabi and Dubai. One of the oldest continuously operating Christian church in the world is in Iran. St. Porphyrios Church, which is the oldest continuously operating Orthodox church, Christian church in the world, was in Gaza, and then the Israelis bombed it and killed 14 women and children inside. So yeah, there are a lot of churches in the Middle East. The first time I went to Damascus, Syria, 1993, under that dreaded dictator, Hafez al-Assad, I went to church on Sunday in a church where St. Paul preached. So yes, there are a lot of churches in the Middle East, a lot. And it's not an either-or prospect where you have to be with the Israelis, you have to be with the Zionists, or else the Muslims are going to torture you and hang you and kill you and throw you off a roof and bulldoze your churches. It's actually the Israelis that stand in the way of maintenance of the churches.
Yeah, this is a really frustrating issue to deal with, because when it tips over into the religious domain, everybody just assumes you either have to choose Israel or you choose Hamas,
right?
Some sort of Muslim faction or something like that. And, you know, people don't even know that in the Middle Ages, I'm not saying we could go back to this, but in the Middle Ages, Jerusalem was at one point a Christian kingdom. So there's no necessity to this being either a Jewish or an Islamic place. It's had a very diverse, it's had a pagan history, right? It's been all kinds of things for thousands of years. So everyone just sort of defaults to whatever is presented as a false choice, that you're either with Hamas or you are, or with the Zionists and with Israel. And you know, it doesn't matter how many times you hammer that home, that's a really difficult thing for people to figure out, because humans just tend to fall into the camps of good guy, bad guys. It's so easy to do that. It's kind of a default, probably from tribal times. My tribe's good, you guys are the bad guys. So we just think of it that way. It must be war propaganda operates in that very simple, low-tier kind of, well, they threw the babies out of the incubators, and are you supporting the babies being thrown out of incubators? Well, then you better go to war, right? You know, I think, yeah, you would know this from your history of teaching and tenure, that this is how propaganda works, right? You know this well. So if we can see through that and see that it's not you don't have to choose one or the other, and there's nuance, there's complexity. You know, Israel, one of the reasons that Israel wanted it once for many years to support Hamas, this is from many Israeli sources, was as a counterbalance to the PLO, because they really didn't like the PLO.
Right.
And Israel has admitted and said many times that a lot of these groups can function as destabilizing forces as well. So these proxy groups, these radical Salafi, Wahhabi, you know, Sunni groups can be a great power for actually giving also Israel the excuse that we have these, you know, problems all around us. Therefore, America, you have to support us. Otherwise, you're anti-Semitic, because look, we have all of these groups around us that are threats. Well, why are you aiding the threats then? Why are you fomenting destabilization in a lot of these countries by design and by admission? They even admit this, right? So, yeah, I think that's an element that people don't see, which is that the destabilization doesn't just keep those that are around Israel sort of off kilter. It also allows Israel to have an excuse to basically, you know, beg the U.S. and tell the U.S. what to do and give them infinite amounts of money. So it's all very, very cunning, I guess you could say, if you think about what's really going on. But everybody is just sort of trapped in this mode, and we're beginning to come out of it. Of thinking in just good guy, bad guy. But it's like, well, if you've watched The Sopranos, you know, Tony Soprano goes to war with, at one point, the five families.
Right.
So who's the good guy, bad guy, right? I mean, it's like, well, they're both bad guys, right? So it's not like we have to choose, you know, Hamas or Israel. But the more you learn about this subject, the more I think you see that it's not good guys, bad guys. But from another perspective, from the religious perspective, on what basis are we supposed to just do whatever Netanyahu says?
Stay with us, Jay. We're going to take a short break and come right back. When we come back, we will have more with Jay Dyer. I'm John Kiriakou, and this is The Deep State. Stay right there. Welcome back to The Deep State. I'm John Kiriakou. We're joined back again today by our guest, Jay Dyer, podcaster, theologian, and expert debater. Thanks so much for being with us, Jay. You made me think of something that happened to me. Wow, 26 years ago, my two oldest sons, I have five children, my two oldest, I only had two at the time. They were very, very much into this fake wrestling, WWE, World Wrestling Entertainment, fake wrestling. And so I decided to treat them, and I bought us three tickets to see the wrestling matches at Madison Square Garden in New York. And it starts, and they're smashing chairs over each other's heads and throwing each other onto tables, and the tables collapse, and people are screaming and cheering. And I said to my eldest son, who at the time was, I think, eight, I said, I don't think I understand. Which one is the good guy? And he said, and this was very wise, he said, that's just it, Dad. There is no good guy. And so much about world affairs can be explained with that one sentence. It's not just possible, it's in many cases common that in these big global situations we find ourselves in, there simply is no good guy.
Yeah.
So I want to ask you, in terms of religious minorities in the Middle East, but particularly Christian minorities in the Middle East, and they don't even have to be indigenous. Maybe they're, you know, third country nationals. Let's say Sri Lankan Christians working in Kuwait or whatever they happen to be. How do you assess the freedom that Christians have to practice their faith in the Middle East today? Are things getting better? Are they getting worse? Does it depend on what country we're talking about? How do you assess that?
Well, I would assume that you kind of alluded to this earlier, that it really depends on which nation we're talking about, mm-hmm. because I got more interested in some of this Middle Eastern, you know, religious sectarian stuff probably in around the time of 2012, 13, 14, and 15, when there was really a push to remove Assad. And I had some friends that were journalists that had gone to Syria many times to cover stuff. And so I got more and more interested in that because I wanted to understand, well, now wait a minute, I thought he's Muslim, right? Because a lot of, you know, evangelicals, a lot of people in America, they think, well, if you're Muslim, then you're all Sunni, you know, radical, clerical, you know, Wahhabis, and you got to shut everything down. But there's quite a bit of diversity in sectarian groups amongst Islam. And like you mentioned with Assad, you know, Assad had a reputation for being pretty liberal when it came to the rights of Christians to practice and to worship, particularly Orthodox Christians, you know, in Syria. So what we're being told really didn't make sense with what the reality was that I was hearing from people who were visiting Syria. You know, they could go to Damascus, mm-hmm. like you mentioned earlier, where Paul taught, and go to an Orthodox church. But meanwhile, the BBC is saying Assad is gassing his own people.
That's right.
Which was just obvious, you know, propaganda. And so, you know, what? And I think similar situations in Iran. There might be other limitations on what you can and can't do. But I think there's a little more freedom there than there would be in Saudi Arabia. Now, Saudi Arabia is the ally of America, but you can't preach Christianity
Correct.
Or have a church
yes.
in Saudi Arabia. So we begin to see, well, wait a minute, that makes no sense. Total hypocrisy that, well, we got to go over there and fight for the Christians' freedoms in America, in the Middle East, because the Muslims are shutting them down. Well, if that was the case, then we would not have a friendship with Saudi Arabia, mm-hmm. because that makes no sense. Right. So it really depends on all these different flavors of Islam. And, you know, I had questions about 9/11 back in 2003 and 2004, but I didn't know anything about Islam. And I think, again, everybody just assumes that, you know, Islam is this monolithic thing. It's not. It's very different, very diverse. Sunnis hate Shia. They've been fighting for centuries. There's all kinds of different, you know, levels, you could say. There's a spectrum of what's allowed and not allowed in different. I mean, the British Empire used Sunnis to fight the Ottomans. So you've got Muslim against Muslim there. So my assessment would be that it probably depends on which area that we're talking about. And although Israel perhaps was not as heavy-handed against Christianity in the past several decades that they as they could have been, I think they're beginning now to show their true colors to see this is what they really wanted. They would definitely be heavy-handed against Christianity had they the opportunity to do so. And ironically, yeah, they would be more anti-Christian than some of the Islamic nations.
Right. I want to switch gears, if we may, and I want to ask you about the relationship between the Orthodox Church and nationalism. We hear a lot, well, those of us who follow developments in the Orthodox world hear a lot about nationalism and the role that it has in places like Russia or Serbia, possibly Ukraine. The Greeks have gotten away from nationalism. The Antiochians are too oppressed to even have to be able to deal with something like nationalism. What is your view on this? Is nationalism within the church a positive force, or is it something that we should worry about?
Depends on what you mean. To quote Jordan Peterson, depends on what you mean. Well, because now nationalism has a long history of, prior to the French Revolution, what was the conception of a nation state was more of an ethnos, right? So in the New Testament, the Greek word that's used is the ethnoi or the ethnos, baptize the ethnos, the nations. And presumably the mindset of the biblical authors would have been something like the Table of Nations in Genesis, that you have these sort of genealogical groups that extend out of the, you know, original nations of Genesis 10. But as you get up towards the French Revolution, I'm not trying to do a whole history lesson here, but it's important because there's different conceptions of what a nation state is. And so after the French Revolution, there's a much more post-Enlightenment, post-revolutionary idea of a nation state being something not necessarily tied to an ethnos or a people, but something more propositional connected to a Republican style, you know, statement of constitutional principles. And that's what we have in a lot of modern nation states, which is why they don't really match up with the nationalism that we see in the Middle Ages or in the patristic era. So I think the Byzantine model, at least, always tried to stress a balance of the one and the many. I'm not saying that they successfully always accomplished this, but the idea was that you would have an imperium with a common religious ideology, which would unite people, but you wouldn't want to necessarily absolutely destroy or dilute the various people groups. Mm-hmm. And so there's always going to be a challenge there to maintain that balance of the one and the many, which is what we call that in philosophy. That's just whether the principle of unity, the principle of multiplicity, which one has priority. Well, maybe we should like the Trinity or like the idea of the bishops in the church. Maybe there's a unity and a plurality that's a balance at the same time. So I think the Byzantine model was intended to have that balance. Once you have the dissolution of the Byzantine Empire or something akin to a state power of Christianity, now we're in this weird phase where it's sort of like, yeah, we kind of have these nations or people groups, like you said, with Serbia or Russia, but they're not. It's not like the way we think of a nation state prior to that, French Revolutionary period, because like in Russia, they have, you know, massive amounts of, in Moscow, massive amounts of Muslims in Moscow, which technically really wouldn't be the same ethnos, that's right, even though they could conceivably be a part of the modern nation state. Mm-hmm. Likewise, in America, being an Enlightenment experiment, you have a propositional nation with people from all over the world sort of mixing in, I wouldn't say a melting pot, I don't think it was the original idea, but now it is a melting pot for better or for worse. So it's really complex and difficult. I know that the Russian church issued a document some years ago, 2014 or so, about the Russian church's attitude on nationhood and nation and nationalism. And I think the idea is that we want to have a degree of acceptance and appreciation. We don't want everybody's people group to be diluted and destroyed. That would be like Babel. But we also don't want to exalt the nation state to a form of what's called philotism, which is the idea that the people group and the ethnos are superior to the universality of the gospel. So the gospel calls everybody. Everybody can be part of the same faith. But anytime there's a temptation to make the nation state, it's almost like the Judaizing idea of going back to we're God's chosen people because we're the Greeks or we're the Russians, right? That would be a lateral move back to the Old Testament. Right. The idea is that you can have a nation state, but it's supposed to be kind of subordinate to the faith, right? So as long as we avoid philotism, there's hope and there's possibility for unity amongst multiplicity.
And thank you for watching. This is The Deep State, and I'm John Kiriakou. We'll see you next time.